Good evening. Bomb goes off in Nashville. A controversial set of pardons by the president. The Pope calls for an end to wars in the Middle East and the Blackwater connection. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Friday, December 25th, 2020. A massive explosion shook the largely deserted streets of downtown Nashville early Christmas morning, shattering windows, damaging buildings, and wounding three people. Authorities said they believed the blast was intentional. Police were responding to a report of shots fired when they encountered a recreational vehicle blaring a recording that said a bomb would detonate in 15 minutes. And that was a sound from the moment of the explosion that occurred this morning. Police had begun evacuating residential buildings in the neighborhood located at 2nd Avenue and Commerce in Nashville when the RV exploded. The blast sent black smoke and flames billowing from the heart of downtown Nashville's tourist scene, an area packed with honky-tonks, restaurants, and shops. Nashville Chief of Police John Drake.
Chief John Drake.
Thank you, Don. Good afternoon. This morning, around 5:30 a.m., officers responded to a call for shots fired in the downtown area, specifically 2nd and near Commerce. As officers responded, they encountered an RV that had a recording saying that a potential bomb would detonate within 15 minutes. Officers, upon hearing that, decided to evacuate the buildings nearby. So they began knocking on doors, making announcements, having emergency communications, communicate with everyone to get people safe. Shortly after that, the RV exploded. We had one officer that was knocked to the ground. Another officer is fine. What we have going on now is we have canine dogs, all of them are out, partnering with Tennessee Highway Patrol, our federal partners, and we're sweeping the downtown area just as a precaution to make sure that everyone is safe and that, you know, any service that needed, we can provide that. And so with that said, we don't feel there's any concern in the downtown area of any thing else right now, but we are doing it as a precaution just to search with our bomb dogs.
The Nashville Chief of Police, John Drake. Law enforcement authorities are confirming that human remains have been found in the vicinity of the explosion as of this hour. No other news on the discovery is available at the present time. Meanwhile, the Federal Aviation Administration has temporarily halted flights out of Nashville International Airport due to telecommunications issues associated with the explosion in downtown Nashville. Service was expected to resume by 3 p.m. local time. The RV that exploded was parked in front of a large windowless AT&T facility. President Trump was reportedly briefed on the explosion this morning. The FBI has taken the lead in the investigation. Special Agent in Charge, Matt Foster.
On the technical side, our focus will be on bringing the technical experts of the FBI from across the country, including the FBI laboratory, our hazardous devices school, and our experts from evidence response teams nationwide into Nashville to help process this massive crime scene, along with the ATF, Metro Nashville PD, and the many other partners who were part of this effort that will continue. We will find out what happened here. That's all.
The Nashville Fire Chief is William Swan. He says the department is checking surrounding buildings for damage.
I'm going to give you just a quick update. I know Don earlier had mentioned as far as the fire department's role at EMS, we did transport three individuals with minor injuries. But right now, what we're doing is with our structural engineers, along with our urban search and rescue hazmat teams, we're going into the buildings, making sure, number one, that the building is sound and ensuring that there are no other victims or anyone that are there. So a lot of moving parts. Again, my hat goes off to all the teams working together as one unit, and we'll continue to work on until the job is done. So thank you.
And that's National Fire Chief William Swan. Chief John Drake of the National Police fielded questions from the media.
I can tell you that several of the buildings on 2nd Avenue have structural damage. Several of them have been damaged, some more than others. But we'll get that for you. I know that, as Chief Swan said, the fire department's looking at those structural issues now to determine any more potential impact. There are a number of people working right now on Christmas Day running leads throughout the city from our police department, the FBI, ATF. Answers will be forthcoming. We can't discuss those with you now or exactly what we're looking at, but answers, I'm sure, will be forthcoming. I have no information about any body being found. We do not know whether anyone was in the RV when it exploded. We do not know whether anyone was in the RV when it exploded. So I can't tell you at this point whether there's a potential for a fatality in that scenario. There were announcements coming from the RV, and that's the extent of what we can say at this point. There are cameras throughout this downtown area. Yes, we have been reviewing downtown cameras, and that is all part of the totality of the investigation. As Chief Drake said, we had a number of officers, several officers on 2nd Avenue who were working to protect the public when the explosion occurred. As he said, one of those officers was knocked off his feet. We have some counselors with our officers. Our behavioral health folks are with those officers, ensuring that they're okay. I mean, they went through a very traumatic experience themselves. They went to the residential areas on 2nd Avenue and did their best to get people to safety. Obviously, they heard the announcements coming from this vehicle. They took them seriously and were working to seal the streets, to protect folks, and we think it worked. We think lives were saved by those officers doing just that. All right. Thanks very much, folks.
And a witness to the events leading up to the blast was interviewed by the Tennessean, Nashville's daily newspaper. She says she left the area after she heard the recording play a countdown to the explosion. A resident in the nearby buildings, loft building was Betsy Williams, that's her name. Williams spoke at about 4:30 a.m. Christmas morning after hearing what sounded like multiple rounds of loud, rapid-fire gunshots. Later, after more gunshots, Williams said she called 911. Then she says she heard a repeated warning from the RV. She added, it said, whoever did it did give fair warning. She saw the windows in her loft had been blown out. Through the broken windows, she says she saw a Christmas tree. It was still on inside the building. And a Republican election official in Michigan who initially refused to certify presidential election results says she still fears for her safety. Monica Palmer spoke with the media yesterday.
To know why she felt that that was appropriate. I have friends on both sides of the aisle, Democrats, Republicans. They may not have agreed with my vote. They picked up the phone, they called me, and they asked me why I voted the way I voted. They sent me an email and said, could you explain to me your viewpoint? They didn't threaten to mutilate and kill my family. I'm still fearful. This woman that I don't know has my name, my address, my phone number, my husband's phone number, my employer's information.
Michigan election canvasser Monica Palmer. She was speaking a day after federal charges were announced against Caitlin Jones, 23, who lives in New Hampshire and had allegedly sent the threatening message. It comes as there's heightened awareness of various white supremacists and other organizations that have made threats in the aftermath of the defeat of President Trump in the November election and the upcoming protests that are scheduled on January 6th in Washington, D.C., and again January 20th by the Proud Boys and others who have said they would do anything to stop Joe Biden from becoming president. In world news, an attack carried out Wednesday in the western region of Ethiopia killed at least 222 people, according to the Red Cross. More than 40,000 people fled their homes due to the fighting. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed called the attack a massacre and deployed federal troops there the next day. The military killed 47 armed men accused of attacking the village. Meanwhile, Ethiopia announced today it will hold parliamentary elections next summer. Prime Minister Ahmed, who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for an agreement with neighboring Eritrea, has been trying to control political and ethnic violence throughout the country. Ethiopia, located in the strategic horn of Africa, where U.S. troops have been operating in next-door Somalia. Africa's second most populous nation, Ethiopia has a federal system with 10 regional governments, many of which have boundary disputes or face unrest. The northern Tigray region held its own elections in September in defiance of the federal government, which declared the polls illegal. Subsequent fighting killed thousands and forced nearly a million to flee. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke with Morocco's King Mohammed VI today, invited him to visit Israel. But while welcoming the resumption of relations, the king said Morocco's position regarding Palestine remains unchanged. And nearly 5,000 stranded trucks at the British port of Dover crossed the channel today after troops were deployed to speed up coronavirus testing. France had blockaded the port of Calais following the discovery of new coronavirus variants in England. The French and British governments agreed to end the blockade on Tuesday, but the British authorities said it would take days to clear the long lines of trucks. And by the way, I said coronavirus variants. I meant a new coronavirus variant, one in England. Families that usually reunite on Christmas over a hearty lingering meal stayed home Friday. Services were held online and gift exchanges were low-key in one of the most unusual holiday seasons in decades. Tourism in Italy has virtually vanished, and the government has imposed strict coronavirus restrictions for the holidays. Pope Francis delivered his Christmas blessing from inside the Vatican, breaking with his traditional speech from the balcony to tens of thousands in St. Peter's Square. The most progressive pope in decades, Francis called for an end to war and equitable distribution of the coronavirus vaccine.
I pray to political and government leaders a spirit of international cooperation, starting with healthcare, so that all will be ensured access to vaccines and treatment. May the child of Bethlehem help us, then, to be generous, supportive, and helpful, especially towards those who are vulnerable, the sick, those unemployed or experiencing hardship due to the economic effects of the pandemic, and women who have suffered domestic violence during these months of lockdown. In the face of a challenge that knows no borders, we cannot erect walls. All of us are in the same boat. Every other person is my brother or my sister. In everyone I see reflected the face of God. And in those who suffer, I see the Lord pleading for help. I see him in the sick, the poor, the unemployed and marginalized, the migrant and the refugee, all of us, brothers and sisters. On this day when the word of God became a child, let us turn our gaze to the many, all too many children worldwide, especially in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, who still pay the high price of war.
And as Pope Francis, he said, the invention of COVID-19 vaccines shines a light of hope on the world. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. On September 16, 2007, Baghdad, Iraq was a dangerous place. On that day, a bombing took place a few miles from a busy traffic circle called Al-Nusur Square, which is used by Iraqis to access major roadways across Baghdad. Heavily armed government contractors from the company Blackwater Worldwide entered the traffic circle, cut off the exits, and began shooting unarmed civilians. 34 were shot, 17 died. Eventually, 5 men from Blackwater were sentenced to long prison terms for murder and manslaughter. The incident is called the Nisour Massacre. This week, 4 of the men were pardoned by President Donald Trump, then Assistant Attorney General for National Security Pat Rowan. That's in 2007, a press conference where he announced the prosecutions of the 4 men.
While there were dangers in Baghdad in September 2007, there were also ordinary people going about their lives, performing mundane daily tasks like making their way through a crowded traffic circle. For the safety of these people, as well as U.S. government personnel and their own colleagues, security guards were obligated to refrain from firing their powerful weapons except when necessary for self-defense. The government alleges today that at least 34 unarmed Iraqi civilians, including women and children, were killed or injured without justification or provocation by these security guards in the shooting at Nasser Square. Today's indictment and guilty plea should serve as a reminder that those who engaged in unprovoked and illegal attacks on civilians, whether during times of conflict or times of peace, will be held accountable.
Medea Benjamin from Code Pink.
Donald Trump gave his pardon so far that include the pardoning of four people who were convicted criminals. And the message it sends to the Iraqis is that the American people don't care about the lives of Iraqis. It infuriated a lot of people in Iraq. And it just continues with the U.S. sense that the lives of people around the world whose country we invade and destroy don't matter.
Under the Bush administration, there was really a, at least superficially, it seemed like the government really wanted to get this right at the time because they knew it would have this effect. What does this do to all the work to try and convince Iraqis that the U.S. was there for their benefit?
I don't think there are many Iraqis who think that the U.S. is there for their benefit. The majority of Iraqis want the U.S. to leave, and the parliament in Iraq has asked for the U.S. troops to go. So it's just one more of many examples, and this is a very strong symbolic one because there are very few cases in which people were held accountable for all the abuses they committed in Iraq. But I don't think it really, the Iraqi people think that the Americans are there for them.
You know, what does that say about the U.S. attempts to say that they're trying to do things for, you know, whether we agree with it or not, a lot of people do.
Well, the American people don't want the U.S. to be involved in these overseas interventions anymore because the polls show that it's not just Democrats, but Republicans, Libertarians, Independents all say these wars were not worth fighting. And if you ask Iraqis, there are polls that have been done in Iraq who say that they're worse off than they were under Saddam Hussein. And then countries around the region where people don't like their own government, take Iran, for example, they look at the case of Iraq and say, uh-oh, you know, maybe we're better off trying reforms of our governments instead of overthrowing, because if the U.S. comes in and helps to get rid of a government, things go even worse.
Medea Benjamin from Code Pink. The U.S. attorney who prosecuted the Blackwater men was Jeffrey Taylor. He describes what happened when the Blackwater Raven 23 convoy arrived at the traffic circle.
The four heavily armed vehicles in the Raven 23 convoy entered Nisor Square and then positioned themselves in order to block any traffic from entering the circle. Seconds after the Raven 23 convoy entered the traffic circle, it is alleged that at least six members of the Raven 23 convoy, including the five defendants named in the indictment, opened fire with automatic weapons and grenade launchers on unarmed civilians located in and around Nisor Square, killing, as Pat said, at least 14 persons, wounding at least 20 other individuals, and assaulting but not injuring at least 18. The first victim was later identified as a second-year medical student named Ahmed Haytham Ahmed Al-Rubia, who was driving a white Kia sedan that was approaching the traffic circle from the south. The passenger of that vehicle was also shot and killed. That victim was Dr. Al-Khazali, the mother of the driver of the vehicle. None of the victims of this shooting was armed. The indictment does not charge or implicate Blackwater Worldwide.
And that's the U.S. attorney who prosecuted the Blackwater men, Jeffrey Taylor. Investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill is author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. He gave an interview in 2007 about his book to C-SPAN. The president at the time was George W. Bush.
The leadership of Blackwater is an interesting mix of political bankrollers of the president. The founder of Blackwater and his immediate family have given about $250,000 in publicly identifiable funds to federal campaigns for Republican causes. The vice chairman of the company is a very well-known spy. His name is J. Cofer Black, former head of counterterrorism at the CIA, a former ambassador at large on counterterrorism. He's a major power player, the man who caught Carlos the Jackal, and the guy who told President Bush, I'll bring you Osama bin Laden's head in a box with dry ice. They have Joseph Schmitz, the former Pentagon Inspector General, whose job it was to oversee this war contractor bonanza, who then leaves office in 2005 under fire, of all people, from Chuck Grassley, the Iowa Republican, saying that he'd covered up investigations. Blackwater is peppered with a number of former senior officials and political allies of the president.
Scahill says although the use of private contractors by the military started with the Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who wanted to privatize certain military functions, the real beginning lies with President Bill Clinton's response to the war in the former Yugoslavia.
Clinton allowed a private military firm called MPRI, Military Professional Resources Incorporated, based in Virginia, to go into Croatia during the Yugoslav Civil War and to train the Croatian military. The Croatian military turned around and carried out a blitzkrieg called Operation Storm and Lightning, in which they expelled about 250,000 Serbs from the Krajina. The New York Times called that the single greatest ethnic cleansing of the war. But what it did is it turned the Yugoslav Civil War in favor of the U.S. position. And it happened by putting a few boots on the ground, a couple of retired military guys who talked strategy with the Croatian military, and they were able to effect change in a very radical way on behalf of the U.S. goals in the region. That is viewed, I think, in the industry and among the scholars who've studied this as a real turning point. They actually were on the ground engaging with a foreign military that was an ally of the United States, and it was a successful operation from the viewpoint of the Clinton administration.
According to Scahill, the seeds of the conflict that led to Al-Nusra Square were planted in the city of Fallujah earlier in 2000 when a convoy of Blackwater guards was ambushed and wiped out by local insurgents. The result was the bloodiest battle of the Iraq War and the beginning of the end for the United States occupation of the country.
In many ways, it was the day the war turned. It was March 31st, 2004, 9:30 in the morning. A convoy led by Blackwater made its way into the center of the city. The front of the convoy was a Pajero Jeep with a reinforced bumper, not an armored vehicle. Sitting in that Jeep were two Blackwater contractors. Behind that, there were three empty flatbed trucks being driven by Iraqi drivers. And then taking up the rear was another Pajero Jeep with two other Blackwater contractors. And their mission that day was to go to one end of Fallujah, pick up some kitchen equipment, and bring it back to the other end of Fallujah. At 9:30, they roll into the center of the city. They hit some sort of a roadblock. And within moments, the rear vehicle, the rear Pajero Jeep, is attacked by Iraqi insurgents. They shoot up the vehicle. They begin to tear apart the men inside. The lead vehicle turns around to either get off the X, meaning to get off the scene, or to turn around and help their comrades. And they, too, are overtaken by insurgents. And within moments, the original attackers disappear into the side streets of Fallujah, and a mob descends on the convoy. And they literally tear the men apart. They burn the men. They loot their bodies and take their possessions, and hundreds of people are dancing in the streets. They tie some of them to the back of a car, drive them through the streets of Fallujah, and eventually two of their bodies, charred, lifeless bodies, were hung from a bridge over the Euphrates River. One young man in the crowd held up a homemade sign that said, "Fallujah is the graveyard of the Americans." And for many people, it was the first that they'd ever heard of contractors operating in Iraq, not to mention private military contractors. Some of the headlines that day say four American civilians mutilated in Iraq, but they weren't civilians, nor were they active duty military. They were private military contractors for Blackwater. And what happened after that was the siege of Fallujah. The U.S. military surrounded the city. The Bush administration ordered a massive attack on the city, and that was the first of several sieges of Fallujah. They carried out 37,000 airstrikes, destroyed 19,000 buildings. Hundreds of people were killed. Scores of U.S. soldiers were killed in the various sieges of Fallujah as well. It inflamed the Iraqi resistance.
And as investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill, he's the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. In Iraq, relatives of the Blackwater victims expressed fury with the pardons. Among the pardons are Nicholas Slatin, who was sentenced to life in prison without parole after being convicted of murder, while Paul Slow, Evan Liberty, and Dustin Hurd were convicted of manslaughter and weapons charges. Democratic Representative Hakeem Jeffries spoke on CNN about Trump's pardons and what they mean.
Well, from the very beginning of the Trump presidency, it's been all about the friends and family plan. How can he enrich himself, his family members, his close friends, the wealthiest 1% in this country, as evidenced by the GOP tax scam that was his signature piece of legislation. At this point, nothing would surprise me. 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue has been an ongoing crime scene. Donald Trump is one of the most corrupt presidents in the history of the republic. His behavior makes Richard Nixon look like a choir boy.
And that's Representative Hakeem Jeffries speaking on CNN about Trump's pardons. A lot of this does, in an editorial comment, bring to mind the My Lai massacre in Vietnam and what led to that and the aftermath as well. Closer to home, last night's high winds and heavy rain have put thousands of New York City customers in the dark while causing significant damage across the city. It's currently 44 degrees and the warmest Christmas since 2015, but now a blast of bitterly cold air is moving into this tri-state by Saturday with a high of 34 and a low of 37 expected. Be careful of those icy and slick spots. By Sunday, temperatures should reach 40 degrees. And in a Christmas miracle, NYPD officers bulletproof vest likely saved his life after being shot in the back while responding to a domestic violence dispute on Christmas Eve. The 27-year-old officer was responding to 911 calls from a mother fearful that her daughter's boyfriend was going to come to their Crown Heights home and shoot the place up. Two other officers were nearby and fired seven shots at the shooter, who ran off for another block or so. Eventually, the man put his gun on the sidewalk and laid down on the ground. He was taken into custody without injuries, according to Police Commissioner Dermot Shea.